Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We have on with us today, and I have the honor of welcoming and hosting guest speaker Anthony Payton, speaking on life after prison. Anthony Payton, also a reentry advocate and founder of Anthony Payton Media, LLC, and Shot, now an award-winning multimedia entrepreneur, has much to discuss from his downfall to his greatest achievement. So without further ado, we are going to welcome guest Anthony Tone Payton, publisher at Nashua Digital, principal at Anthony Payton Media, an award-winning multimedia entrepreneur, writer, TEDx speaker, reentry advocate, and consultant. So please, Anthony, I want to welcome you first of all, and thank you so much for coming on the show. And if you will, please give the audience a little bit more about yourself before we get started.
Hi, Leona. I'm honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me. So I'm from Brooklyn, New York, originally. I've been up in New Hampshire for the last, I want to say a total now, maybe 15, 20 years. Yeah, the life after incarceration right now is something that is just on such a good trajectory, and it took some work to get there. It took some work to get there, though, Leona. So that's what I plan to definitely talk about, the rise and the fall and then the rise again, you know?
And this is what we'd like to hear about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's always good to have someone on that has stumbled at some point in time and comes back stronger than ever. And from what I understand, you have come back really stronger than ever. So this is why I feel that your story is going to make so much of a difference on the show today. And the audience, I'm sure, are going to be very interested in listening. And audience, right. If you want to call in at any time, if you have any questions, you want to make any comments, please feel free to call in at number 657-383-1630. Again, 657-383-1630. And Anthony will be giving his contact information and all his information after he finishes and before the show ends. He will repeat it again. Again, thank you so much, Anthony. And I'll let you
thank
take
you.
The floor now.
Well, yeah, I was I had a TED Talk recently, so I'll give you a brief of that. I was born and raised in the housing projects of Brooklyn, New York. But I'm kind of an anomaly because I grew up in a two-parent home when there wasn't many two-parent homes around at the time. And my parents had everything set up for us to succeed. You know, we had family vehicles. They stressed education. Food was in a refrigerator. We had no worries. But outside of our door was a different story. You know, it was drug dealing, chaos, murder, you name it. When I was around 12 years old, I started to notice a decline in my family. The Christmases weren't as bright, you know, and the refrigerator didn't have as much food. What happened was my dad, he was a Vietnam vet, but he was working and he was laid off, and he picked up a heroin habit. And at the same time, my mother was a diabetic, and she had to leave work, and her diabetes just got worse and worse and worse and worse. And so we had both of those things happening in our household at the same time. And so what does a 12 and 13-year-old boys, what do? They get involved in the trade that most of our peers were involved in, which was drug dealing. And so that, at 13 or 14, I remember selling my first vial of crack to a family friend. Because in the late, in the early mid-80s, early 90s, that's what it was. It was primarily crack and cocaine. And, I sold it to that family friend, and I remember going to buy two slices of pizza, a couple of loose cigarettes, played video games, and I kind of felt like a man because I didn't have to ask my parents for money. And it was at that point where I tasted blood as far as that fast money, and that blood never really leaves the taste of your mouth. And decades after that, I struggled with that shortcut. After facing incarceration, because with drug dealing eventually comes violence and you have to address things. And wind up doing time in New York State Prison. While I was there, my mother died, right? So after 4 years later, I get out. My dad's there. And, you know, I had a few years of pro-social behavior, working and things like that, and, you know, trying to invest in things in a legit way. But, you know, you go back to your old habits if you're not completely ready. So when I walked out of that New York State prison at 24, I thought I was ready, but really I wasn't. And that led to more incarceration with trying to get that fast money. So now you fast forward, I'm in my mid-30s. I'm in New Hampshire. I have an entertainment company. I have a fiance. We have a place together. I'm back in college trying to do it the right way. But, you know, here again, here comes the drug game. And I submerged myself back into it. Even though it was part-time, it was still sufficient enough to warrant me a federal bid. And 3 days into that incarceration, my fiance at the time said, hey, I miss my lady time. Another day after that, here comes the ultrasound picture. And now that ultrasound picture, I used toothpaste and put it up under the bunk of the overhead bed. And that picture was my motivation, that ultrasound picture. 3 years later, I'm in a federal prison now. This little girl is growing, and my dad was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. My fiance at the time would take my daughter to New York, get film, record video of my dad and her together just so I can see it when I got out. And I still watch those videos to this day, but I remember talking with my dad. I called home one day, and my brother said, I'm glad you called. I'm in the hospital with Dad, and the doctor said he may not make it through the night. And so I said my last words to my father over that federal prison phone. So when you do the math, I lost my mother while incarcerated. Now I lost my father, and my daughter was born, not to mention countless aunts and uncles and, you know, and friends that have, you know, passed away and was murdered and things like that, and I missed all of it.
And how old were you, Anthony, when you lost your mother and then your father?
I was 75, 85, 90. I was 23 when I lost my mother, and I was, 42 maybe when I lost my dad. Mm-hmm. And, nearly 20-something years later. And, my last words to him, you know, we expressed our love for each other, and then I went back to my cell, and I put a towel over my head, and I just wept and wept and wept and cried and cried. And, the next day, the guys on the cell block, they made a card for me. And those guys were, mafia hitmen, Mexican drug cartel members, black drug kingpins all around the country. But one common denominator was that a lot of us were fathers or sons or uncles or brothers, so they felt my pain as well. And they rallied around me to make sure I was good. But, you know, I used that stuff for fuel, Leona. Like, I was writing while I was in there. And more importantly, that is where I recalibrated it, right? Because when you're inside and when you're incarcerated, you have to look in that mirror. And I always say that mirror is one of the most feared things that people have in their apartments. You know, even to this day, my daughter's 10, and sometimes she's in the bathroom washing her hands, and I go in and I make her stare in the mirror at herself, especially young girls. And I tell her that she has to have, when she's looking in that mirror, her self-talk has to be higher than anything that she knows. You know, your self-talk and your self-motivation in this mirror have to be big. Now, I can't get too deep with her because she's only 10. But I spoke to a bunch of young girls, and I told them that, you know, when he or she isn't treating you right, or when he or she cheats on you, or when he or she leaves you, that relationship you have with the person in the mirror has to be strong. And you are your number one supporter, and you are responsible for your own happiness. So I try to instill that in my daughter right away. And but on the inside, yeah, I had to come to grips with, hey, I struggle with things like, thinking I can get away with things. And RDAP is a program in the feds called RDAP. It's called super optimism, where I feel I can get away with things. And I don't engage as much in willingness. And I had to step out of my comfort zone, Leona, in order for me to grow. Everything I'm doing now is out of my comfort zone. I'm a natural introvert by nature, but I learned how to play the middle of the field. I think it's called an ambivert, in between extrovert and introvert. And so I do that to get out of that comfort zone that I've been in, that I was in for 40 something years, you know. And I began working in the kitchen when I got to the federal system, and I always loved to cook. And I was surrounded by correction officers. This was unreal, the relationships that we had, because usually the relationship with the correction officer is adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
These particular correction officers, they did not want us to leave their kitchen until we had every certification that was in there. And so the woman who ran the kitchen, Miss M, she was like, look, you will not leave this kitchen until you're ServSafe certified, until you have an apprenticeship with the state of Connecticut for food service manager. If you were working in her warehouse, she wanted you to get forklift license, a material handler license. If you worked in the laundromat, you should, all of that. And so starting to recalibrate and change how you think starts inside. I'm a firm believer that you should be working on your reentry plan the day that you were sentenced. So if you get sentenced, I don't care if it's 5 years or 10 years, that next day you need to be building your plan on what you're going
to
do when you get out. Because freedom
like
is one thing.
Uh-huh. I'd like to ask a question on that one.
Yeah.
How long were you in altogether?
On this particular federal bid, I was in for 7 years, 6 years and 10 months exactly.
Did you ever meet any of the incarcerated individuals who really wanted to take programs and were denied or deprived of the opportunities? Because I've been advocating for 20-something years now, and initially actually having an organization where we did national advocacy work with the men, women, and youth. And throughout the years, and even in my own experience with my own loved one, there have been times when they have deprived, to this day, to deprive targeted prisoners from doing anything so that they will have nothing to show if they go up for parole. I know there's a lot of them, as you mentioned, who don't want to do anything. But for those that do want to do it, there are times, have been many times, where the officials or the correctional officers have deprived them of participating in anything. And you can speak on that a little bit further as you go on.
Yes, absolutely. So I can't say that happened on a federal bid, but I remember being in certain states when I did a little state time. And, yeah, it was just a library with old books. They may have had, like, a remedial reading programs and stuff like that, but there was nothing there that would benefit them in society, right? So, you know, those situations do happen where there are men and women, men and, from what I know of, and I've heard about women, but men and women who want to better themselves, but it's like, what do we do? Like, what are we supposed to do other than read the books that are in this library? And where staff, you know, you put 100 requests in, hey, can we get some trade books here? You know, like, you know, viable employment opportunities, you know, things that you study that will get you gainful employment when you're released, you know? And there were times that I did run into situations like that, and you have to depend on self, or if you have family, hey, send me this book, send me that book. And then, you know, it's on you to pass it around to your friend. Like, yeah, my family just bought me this book. I studied it for 6-7 months. I'm giving it to you, you know, and you study it. So we kind of had to rally around each other at times where the administration didn't have anything for us or didn't want to donate or get donations, which doesn't take much, really, you know. And no, yeah, those situations did happen, Leona. Yeah, yep, very true.
It's a shame. It's a shame. Mm-hmm. And that's why it makes you even more special, because You're one of the few that end up making it out again, and one of the few that are able to get to the point where you yourself have brought yourself so far up. But I believe that was in you. I don't know about the programs you received. That was good that happened, but it was your determination that you wanted to make sure that you achieved, and you achieved big time.
Right, because I left so many men who could jump on the pull-up bar and do 50 straight. These guys do thousands of push-ups. They're in the greatest physical shape. And when you go into the television room, it's just ESPN. It is Love and Hip Hop. It is Mob Mafia Wives. It is There's nothing that is going to better them. So, yes, there's an individual thing as well, you know, where, hey, listen, man, like, we can't play cards and chess all day. Like, let's get into something else. Let's figure out what is our game plan when we leave these doors, because freedom is one thing and success is another thing, you know. So I just followed that path, and like I said, I walked out of there, and I'm looking at it on my wall right now, Office of Apprenticeship Certification of Completion for Apprenticeship, Food Service Manager, FCI Danbury, Connecticut, United States Department of Labor. That certificate, which I have laminated, helped parlay me from a cook to now where I have cooks under me, cooks and dishwashers under me, and I'm going for recertifications and things like that. So, you know, while you're in there, you have to be working towards getting out. So if you have a loved one inside and you speak with them on the phone, and if they're telling you everything about what LeBron has done last night and, you know, what latest rapper has done this and this and that, that's the point where you say, hey, look, nice, beautiful, but what are you doing? What are you actively doing that is going to get you, that is going to make sure you stay out? How are you going to get a grasp on economics? Because usually that is the root of every time a guy or man or woman is committing a crime, either behind addiction or just money, you know. And so what are we doing to stop that? You know, here are, and that's where it comes back into, does the prison have things in it? Like again, where I was at in Danbury, we walk through the kitchen, it says, hey, serve safe certification. If you have that in this state, it starts you at $18 an hour. And such. So they were motivating, like, we had that there. A lot of places don't have that. That was so different where any other place that I've ever been. New York State Prison gave free college, though. And so I had a brother that walked out of there with his master's degree out of Sing Sing, actually, Sing Sing Correctional Facility in New York. And he took that master's degree and parlayed it to Columbia University. Yeah, Ivy League school. It can be done. He took that master's that he got from there and went and got another master's from Columbia. Then he went and got another master's from Baruch College, you know, and now he's living his best life and still climbing and striving. So that's why even now I'm so big on college inside of prison. And that's one of the things and people that I associate with who are trying programs like that to put college inside of the prisons. And one guy, he had a team. He took his students from college and went into a Connecticut State prison for an academic face-off, Leona, right? And he said that his students got their butts kicked and by the inmate students. His students on the street got their butts kicked by the inmate students in an academic face-off. And from that moment, he has done nothing other than try to get college into prisons for free, you know, and, you know, at least for them to have a pathway to that, because it has been shown statistically, Leona, like you can go to the RAND, R-A-N-D, and it'll tell you, for every dollar that we spend to incarcerate someone, we save $5 by either educating them, you know, with college or employment skills. So it's a complete win when we put college and education into schools. It's statistically proven. You know, you're speaking with one. I have a brother that's one. Like, it's statistically proven. You know, so we have to have those programs in there. And actually, up-to-date programs, there should be AI classes in every prison right now. What is AI and how do I work it? How can I make it work for me? You know, if you really want to see that population thrive and go, then we need to be putting more modern things in there. Now, they have things like electrical, plumbing, you know, trades and stuff like that in certain prisons, you know. But it's just overall, it's going to have to start within. And if you don't have the support around you, like you said, there are places where staff is against you and they don't want you learning and stuff like that. Figure it out. You know, call home, hey, send me this book. Can I get this book in here? And so, when you're talking to that relative or friend, and they're talking about the latest trends, you know, ask them what they're doing. What book can I send you right now? When I was in, one of my brothers sent me The Dummy's Guide to Screenwriting, right? And then he also sent me another one which had to do with screenwriting because I love writing, and it was called Save the Cat. And those were both books about how do you develop your script and things like that and writing. And so I also, at the same time I was in the kitchen, right, I was also working on the home run hit. you know, which is, hey, I want to write a movie. I want to write a television show. I want a podcast and things like that. How do I do this? You know, I also learned how to deal futures when I was in there. So I got out and I opened a stock account immediately with Tastyworks and was doing day trading from what I learned inside, you know. And again, Leona, that's not – that comes with maturity. 20 years ago, I wasn't thinking that deep or that far. But on this go-around, I did, and I think that it should be supported when people are in that position. So
I was going to say, because, you know, this month, it was March 4th, on WBZ, they were talking about advocates saying that Massachusetts prison system is setting inmates up to fail. I want to ask you a question about your possibility of your role in going in. But anyway, mm-hmm. in Boston, with the average prison stay in Massachusetts lasting 4 years, most incarcerated people do get released. But while they are in prison, are they getting the education and job training they need to keep them from going back? Mac Hudson went to prison at 17 and spent 33 years behind bars for what he said was mostly for a crime that he did not commit. Hudson is now out on parole and working with prison legal services. He told the I-team that few inside prisons are getting the education or are taught the skills to make it on the outside. I feel like we are purposely being set up to fail. Being set up to fail because advocates say programs like the dog training and dozens of other listed in the Department of Corrections 2023 brochure are not always available or open to everyone. The majority of those programs that are listed, they don't exist. Then there are programs that used to exist but no longer exist. The Department of Corrections fiscal year 2024 budget is more than $800 million. But the I-team found less than 2% is earmarked for educational opportunities and reentry programs. Bonnie Tenorello is with Prison Legal Services, and she said that that is a mistake. It doesn't work. They get out of prison, and when you have warehoused them and treated them inhumanely, you are setting them up to fail when they get out. The I-team found the average annual cost to house an inmate in Massachusetts is more than $178,000. We are one of the most expensive prison systems in the country, State Representative Uter Hoven said. Currently, there are only 113 individuals that are incarcerated students in a higher degree education program. This is where they have been denying a lot of these prisoners education. That is across the board. Shameful numbers for a department that costs taxpayers $800 million a year. And the Department of Corrections shared recent photos from a Tufts University graduate at MCI Concord. But in the statement, a DOC spokesperson said, the Massachusetts Department of Corrections collaborative and results-driven approach to education and demand job skill training and transformative mentorships has reduced recidivism to a historic low. The department works closely with numerous strategic partners. But this is a big problem that we have in the Massachusetts prisons is that prisoners are not only deprived, but many are targeted and prevented from participating in any programs. They pick and choose, which I think is terrible. But this is just Massachusetts. I'm thinking around the country. But what I wanted to ask you really, Anthony, is would you or are you ever able to set up some kind of a program where you're able to go into the prisons and you're able to not only share your own story, but also to do something with your media, your multimedia work that you do?
Well, I was helping someone build a nonprofit that was going to help prisons, but I had to move away from it. We had to be parted, mutual part, so to speak. But I have been to counties up here where I've gone inside and spoken. I was housed at one place I was at, and theory, I hear it is 8 years later, I'm going back there to talk to the people, you know, and I would love to do more of that. I gave a workshop in Concord, New Hampshire that would talked about incarcerated parents, you know, and what the struggles may or may not be. So yeah, I would love to get more involved with Massachusetts. That's just like put chills up my spines with what you just said. I think Massachusetts is going to have to come to a reckoning like, hey, listen, You know, first of all, it needs to be more equity on their boards. At least in New Hampshire, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but at least in New Hampshire, like if you look at some of the DOC and their advisory boards and judges and at-risk youth and the court diversion programs, there are a lot of formerly incarcerated people involved at every step of it. And maybe I can't say about Massachusetts, but I think that needs to happen. And those statistics from the Rand University need to be blaring and glaring everywhere. $1 spent to incarcerate, $5 saved to rehabilitate.
Exactly.
And there should be no argument that what are we fighting about? Because here's the thing, here's the reality. This untrained person who just sat in a warehouse comes out and he's in a laundromat next to your son or your daughter. You want that person to have every skill that they need to be a productive, upwardly mobile member of society. And that is the investment. These people are going back into our communities. We're coming back into communities. And I'm sorry to say, you know, it could be good communities or bad communities, but you will, Massachusetts residents, whoever's listening, you will come across formerly incarcerated people. And don't you want them to have the best chances at survival? Don't you want them to not have to turn back to what they were doing previously? You know, and they have a chip on their shoulder as well because they just left conditions that they may not want to return back to. You know, so that means that they're not, you know, they're going to fight tooth and nail, you know, if things come down to it. So, you know, that reckoning, let's not see it get there. Let's be supportive, you know.
You know, there are so many that do come out that come out with that post-incarceration syndrome. You
yes.
know, and this is another thing that I believe a lot of people are not aware of in society. And you can explain a little bit about that. But I wanted mm-hmm. to let you know, it's a program called it's the Deep Heart Program. Deep Heart, I don't know if you've heard of it.
No, Deep?
Deep Heart, H-E-A-R-T program.
Okay.
And Ruth, her name is Ruth Mercy, but she is the manager and event coordinator. And her WhatsApp number is 702-305-8491. And this is a group, they tour the world, the prisons throughout the world. And I had sent her a letter asking her if they would be willing to come to the Massachusetts prisons. And she wrote back and she said, hello, Leona, how are you doing, lady? It was such mm-hmm. a blessing to receive your email and hear from you. Thank you so much for getting in touch. It would be an honor and blessing to work with you and visit the prisons there in Massachusetts. What they do, Anthony, is mm-hmm. it's pretty much like with what you do, it would be such a compliment to work with
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And right now they're in Colombia. Bogota, I can't pronounce it. But they're going to be, and she said they're currently in Colombia working in the horrible prisons here and there. We hope to make it to the East Coast of the U.S. by late fall, and I will stay in touch, and it'll give you a better idea on the specific date.
Wow.
But these people, they play instruments like rock and everything else, but there's messages in their music and the work that they're doing. So if you can connect with them, I think it would work out really good, because what you've been through and what you're doing and what I'm sure they must have started this international tour to the prisons around the world because
mm-hmm.
some or others were also inside at some point in time.
Wow. I will definitely be reaching out to them. And just again, like I said, I would love to go in there and teach. And that would be one of the first things I say to groups of men that are in there, like, hey, you know, this rehabilitation is on you. Like, start writing, like, what books can you guys get in here? Because you want to come back out into this world ready. Like Leona, I literally walked out of that prison, that federal prison. It was on a Tuesday, rainy outside, December 10th. Had my bag with clothes and, you know, a few clothes and pictures. Took the bus from Danbury to New York. My brother was there waiting for me with a phone and some cash, and he had the phone ready. I haven't paid a phone bill. Them guys had my plan, so I was blessed. And that footage of my dad playing with my daughter was in that phone. You know, and I cried on that bus to Boston looking at that footage. And then I caught the bus from Boston to New Hampshire and then went to the federal halfway house. And I had a resume with me. I had my resume was in hand, cook resume, to do cooking and food service manager. And bang, I went right to cooking. You know, I did, I think, warehouse in between, but I stuck with the cooking for a I actually cook for a mental health facility right now. I'm the food service manager in there. And so we deal with people who are also, and I'm in a non-clinical role, of course, but people who have dual diagnoses. Some of them were formerly incarcerated, and I like speaking with them, you know. And I would remind those guys inside of the prison, look, you're going to walk this walk. You know, you have to get yourself ready to come out. I don't care what age you are, you know, whether it's, you know, 26 or 66, you know, or even older. Like, we have to lay that foundation now. While you guys are going back, lay your foundation and write it down. Because when you write it down, it makes it more tangible, you know. So those are some of the things that I would like to just one of the many things that I would like to get across to those men, because that's a critical time, you know.
And as this woman said, Ruth, when she wrote this, she said, I can't agree with you more on the perspective, the points that were shared in the work that we do. The justice system is so broken. Society breaks men and then condemns them for being broken.
Yes.
She said, I have met so many men who received life without parole at 16 years of age, as mm-hmm. if 10 to 15 years is not enough time for a man to change. No fathers, and have not even had the chance to grow up. Then the world throws them away with no help and no chance to change. So many minorities that suffer horrible injustice, often because they simply cannot afford a decent lawyer or did not understand the specifics of a plea deal being offered to them. So stand mm-hmm. strong in all that you do and fight on. But what I was going to say is on April 2nd, Tuesday, April 2nd, I believe it's next week or the week after, I'm going to be having the radio show with people from across the pond. We're going to have people from Belgium and London. We're going to have people from the Netherlands. And we're going to have a criminal defense lawyer from Texas. And we're going to be discussing on the radio show a platform to do the international, a Zoom meeting, a virtual Zoom meeting with people from all over the countries in the world. And we're going to be talking about exactly what you're talking about now and what these people have been talking about in the prison system. You mentioned you did your resume when you came out. In 2004, when I first started New Vision Organization, we were doing national work. And what I would do for those that were coming out, I would help them with their resumes, and I would write a generic letter that would go with them when they came out to go to the thrift shops or the retail stores and could get some decent clothing for free so that they could start applying for work. And the letters did work in some of the thrift shops. They were able to get up to $40 or $50 worth of free clothing, and then they'd have their resume. But this is what the prison system needs to do. All this money that they're getting, and people think they're eating well, but they're not eating well. They're eating a lot of potatoes and a lot of rice, anything to make them fat, look fat, so that people think that they're fed properly. But I'm sure you, formerly being in before, I'm sure you know what that's all about.
Oh, my God, I happen to be on the higher side of the, because I worked in the kitchen, so I was a, but for the most, I don't know, maybe the federal system is a bit different. It kind of took a down slid a little bit, but I remember being in some state places and the stuff was coming right out of a bag and it's like, oh my God, like how is this nutritious? And the commissary items are a joke. Everything's in a can or a pouch, and you know you don't want to do 8-10 years eating processed foods, you know, and snacks, you know, and then the same guys are going to medical with all of these issues, and medical is subpar, you know. So, yeah, it's a vicious cycle. Definitely not the nutrition, definitely not enough sunlight unless you're out in the yard all the time. The stress is just such a volatile environment, just the stress, and there's not enough that addresses mental health either, you know, and that needs to be addressed. You know, men have, you know, there's a lot of trauma in there. Yeah, and Yeah, and I wrote something on that when I walked out. Like, it was about a year or so. I was still washing my boxers, my boxer briefs. I take a shower with my boxers on. And I had girlfriends, you know, playful teasing, like, what are you doing? You know, it's like, hey, this is what I knew. This is the most comfortable. And sitting with your back to, you know, it's just like military veterans that get out of the military after a while. You know, you have to become a civilian again. And that's not overnight sometimes, you know. And so those are like underlying issues and even relationships, you know. If a man left his home for 4 years and now he's back in that home, the child is a little bit older, he and the woman may not get along. How does he feel going into the refrigerator? You know, how does he feel disciplining that child, you know? And so those are situations that arise for people that are formerly incarcerated, not even mentioning, you know, filling out resumes and, you know, you got to check that box if you've been arrested before and things like that. So I would also encourage to get to those felon-friendly fields. Massachusetts, with all of its land, there's no reason that every state prison in Massachusetts shouldn't have a CDL program on its premises. You get 3 tractor trailers and you show those guys how to get around and move, obviously in a closed environment, but you start that process in there. You know, even construction, that's another field that is what I call felon friendly. You know, there should be a culinary program in each prison as well. So when those men and women get out, okay, I can become a sous chef, not just a cook. I can make this thing into a career. You know, and then like I said, AI. Out on the West Coast, they're teaching them coding. I think in Baltimore they may be too. They're teaching them computer coding, you know. But AI is about to take that over. So like let's teach these men about what AI is. And then on the financial side of things, you know, how do these men know what credit is? Because most guys who are dealing drugs and things along those lines, they didn't care about what their credit score was. They didn't even know what that was. They didn't even use credit cards. It was all cash paper. We wanted no paper trail. Now when you get out, you go purchase a vehicle or something like, hey, what's your credit score? Oh, I never knew this was something that I had to, you know, partake in. And so that should be started in there. Everyone should know, listen, when you walk out of there, your credit score is this. Here's your FICO score. Actually, not even just the credit bureaus. What is my FICO score when I leave out of here? So I can know, so I just don't apply for a credit card and I'm shooting in the dark. Let me know what I'm eligible for, or, you know, or how to leverage credit when I get a business, or how to start your own LLC. You know, those type of classes should be afforded inside of the prisons.
You know, you really need to, you're going to have to come back on again because we have to hear more about this. But I want to go back to the mental health issues. And this is a passion of mine, is to try to get some kind of resolution to the mental health problems we have in this country, mental health and addictions. It's an epidemic. And
yes.
I get so upset because it's in the prisons and it's in the communities. And yet the focus, the priorities are not on the mental illnesses and addictions in this country. And I get so mad when I think about them worrying so much about these other countries, when their own country is falling apart. In mental illness, I'll tell you, people think that mental illness just involves mental retardation. They don't realize there are so many people in prison, thousands and thousands, who are suffering from mental illnesses because they have been traumatized as children. They have been violated as children. They have been abused. They have been in domestic violent homes. They've been in infested environments in their communities. And what's happening right now is, with the mass shootings and everything else, these are young people that not only have a psychological problem, but a lot of them come from homes where their parents are actually, or their fathers are actually teaching them to hate, teaching them to do these things. And they're trying to please their fathers. And here what happens is they either get killed by the law enforcement during the process, or they go to prison for life and life without. Look, a 17-year-old just recently got sentenced to prison for life without parole. Because he shot how many people in Houston, Texas? But we have to do something about these the mental health in this. And I'll tell you, there was a psychologist that evaluated a prisoner. And I have to say this because this goes to show you how incompetent the medical providers that are contracted with these DOCs are about. This psychologist failed to put down that the prisoner as a child had been violated, had been molested, and that was nowhere in the report. And then he said the mother and father were alive, living together, were alive and well. Well, the father was never involved with the family. The father was never involved with this child growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And to top it off, the father had died of cancer in 2012 when this evaluation was being written up in 2017. So everything in that report, and then the psychologist stated that the person had antisocial behavior, but yet in the trial transcripts, the initial trial transcripts of this incarcerated individual, the psychiatrist from Yale stated that that individual did not have antisocial behavior, but he suffered from severe depressive episodes with psychotic behaviors. So now we have these people in prison who are being diagnosed with antisocial behavior, and they're not even getting treatment, and still they're not even suffering from antisocial behavior, but PTSD or other disabilities like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people don't realize how much mental health plays a part, and those underlying issues are why a lot of guys, men and women, can't function right when they get back into society. So if you have them warehoused, is it just a warehouse for human beings, or are we trying to help make people better? You know, because and I've been in there's a program in the feds called RDAP, stands for Residential Drug and Alcohol Program. And you do 9 months. It takes a year off your sentence if you're eligible. You take a year off your sentence. I actually got a year off my sentence because of this program, 9 month intense program. And don't you know, Leona, rarely ever did we talk about drugs in that program. You know, it was all criminal thinking behavior. We had therapists in there, behavior, and almost programming us in some regards. And some of that stuff I held on to, you know. But, you know, you get deeper. I had a friend who watched he's from another country, I won't get into specific, but he watched his dad, you know, chop someone's head off in their homeland, you know. And you had another guy who was ex-military, right? He grew up in the projects, went to Iraq, and, you know, he was over there. He you know, he said he had to, you know, kill kids, you know, because he broke down in tears. What are you doing if it's an 11-year-old kid lifting a rocket launcher pointing at you, you know? And what are you supposed to do, not take him out? And he had to process that stuff. And here he's going back into society, not with just the trauma of his youth, but the trauma of the military, you know. And here we just letting guys walk around, you know, walk out there without any type of assistance treatment, or even know where to go, a treatment. Where do I go? Who do I talk to? Because we need to process and unload, you know. And there's still a stigma attached to it, I believe, especially in communities of color. Our therapy is in barbershops. You know, and I'm trying to get us away from the, hey, look, man, look, we need to sit down with a professional, because you've been through too much trauma to think that, you know, the brothers in the barbershop can help you dissect it. You know, it's great to unload, but you need to be able to unload with a professional as well. And so I think we have to afford that to people in one way or another. And so, mental health definitely plays a big part, definitely.
It does. And a lot of people think, because when they hear about addictions, there's a lot of people who have become addicted, and society may think they're just doing it because it's fun. They like to do it. They like to party and everything. But I believe a lot of these people that are addicted because they're trying to cover up a lot of pain themselves, what they went through. So if it's not affecting them mentally in other ways, it's affecting them with even being able to cope without being strung out. And the prisons, from what I understand, and it's a common knowledge really, is that a lot of these people in prisons, they're being fed drugs. And it's not coming in family members and friends, as they try to say, because I say this all the time. If people go on the internet and they type in guards caught smuggling drugs into the prisons, they're going to find out that all of these drugs are coming in from the staff. So how does that help rehabilitate people when in fact they're bringing it in?
Right. There was an epidemic they had at Danbury Correctional Facility with, it was cell phones, you know, just cell phones in there left and right. I know guys that are literally in jail right now, and they have Facebook profiles, and you can see the prison inside. I'm like, God, you know. And the same thing with drugs. And one correctional officer, you can Google it, in Danbury, he got a woman pregnant It's just wild. And like I said, Leona, what I went through with that staff of correction officers, that was like, it was cinematic. It's unreal, unheard of, you know, because like I said, it's always adversarial. 9 out of 10, or 8 out of 10 that I've ever had in my life through 13 and a half years of incarceration total. It's always been adversarial. Even though I stayed out of their way, it's always been adversarial. And yeah, drug addiction. I saw a guy smoke K2, which was synthetic marijuana, right? He smoked it, and then he got into a fight with the shower mat. In his mind, the shower mat was fighting him, and he was twisting it. He had the shower mat holding it, twisting around, tripping and falling on the floor. And another guy was stuck at the water fountain, couldn't move. Another guy would get the boxes and crush him up. He was, you know, they would give you maintenance if you were on opioids, so in form of Suboxone. And even with that, even if it's coming through medical, Leona, it's still a level of abuse. They're not watching those guys. Those guys take it, hide it under their tongue, lift their tongue up, and then go back to the unit, crush it up, and snort it, you know. And then when they're kicking the correction officers, if you got the right or wrong ones, they're bringing it in, like you said. And so that cycle is going to all – that cycle continues. Psych meds as well, you know. So it's a heck of a position and predicament. And I think that the training that correction officers have, that has to be tweaked somehow. You can't just take a guy off the streets, a man or woman off the streets, and then put him in that position. The temptations is driving around. You have drug kingpins in there who will tell a correction officer, hey, if you get me a $300 phone, I'll give you $1,000 for it because I'm going to sell it for $2,000. That's how much an iPhone goes for inside of the prison, around $2,000. And now they're doing that with phones. They do that with phones. They're doing the same thing with drugs, you know, and tobacco. All that stuff was in there, Leona. Yeah, all of that stuff was in there. And federal prison is very segregated as far as geography. And I was with the New York guys. And when my paperwork came in, right, to show that I didn't tell on anyone, I wasn't a snitch or I wasn't a sex offender. Once that was cleared, they brought me into the showers fully clothed and showed me an ice pick, a cell phone, marijuana, K2, and some cigarettes. And they say, what do you need? You know, and I was like, wow. You know, and
that was correctional officers?
No, it was fellow inmates.
Oh,
but
okay.
But Leona, you don't get a carton of Newports and a real ice pick and a cell phone. You're not smuggling that on a visiting floor. You know, you're not putting that, you're not, I don't care how good you are, not a carton of Newport. You know, that came in from the street. That came in from, like, you know, staff. You know, so, yeah, it's a lot goes on in there that, very questionable stuff, you know.
That's why I say people in society, they just don't have a clue, you know, of everything that's going on. And another thing is a lot of times they look at the uniforms or they look at the titles. And they think because they're wearing these uniforms or titles that, you know, they're entitled to do that. They're not. They're human beings just like anyone else.
Right.
And to be getting away with that kind of, you know, recently in Massachusetts again, just this year, 5 days ago, Richard Evans, 65 of Hanover, was convicted of conspiracy to commit theft. This is the former chief of police. Conspiracy to commit theft concerning programs receiving federal funds, theft concerning programs receiving federal funds, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, and they said there were hundreds of thousands of dollars that were made throughout that time. And they also mentioned it's not just with him, but it's with, I believe, 6 other officers. So he's retired now, but apparently, you know, they say that he was convicted 4 days ago by a federal jury in Boston of orchestrating and participating in a long-running overtime fraud scheme at the Boston Police Department evidence warehouse that cost taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars in fraudulent overtime payment. So these are the kind of things that go on. You wonder, or I wonder, With all this money going into the prisons, why isn't there more rehabilitation? Why aren't more people being allowed to participate in these programs? And I, running an organization, again, when I was running the organization, working with all these prisoners, we had clients in the organization from Massachusetts. There was one client that actually, there was a prisoner, another prisoner of color, working in the culinary department,
mm-hmm.
and they found a way to get rid of that person of color that was in the culinary program by saying he didn't have prior clearance, when in fact he did. So they took that job from him, and they gave it to another prisoner. And what they didn't realize is that prisoner was one of our clients, and he was talking about how he had just gotten this job in culinary after they got rid of this other person.
Yeah.
These are the kind of things that go on, and this is why I feel that there needs to be independent oversight. And when I talk about things, I'm not just talking about Massachusetts prisons. I'm talking about prisons across the country. Look at Lowell Prison, Lowell Prison in Florida for females. There were so many female prisoners. You mentioned being raped by guards. There were so many in Lowell Prison in Florida. They had to do an investigation. But all these women were being raped by the guards.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. What they think is like Mary or something, you know, like out of the Bible. She just had this immaculate conception. Somebody's over there, you know, doing something. Like it's and this girl in Danbury Correctional Facility, she held that guy's stuff. You know, she held his sperm, and I think he, what did he get, 2 years, I think, or something like that. I'm not sure. But, he was a prick, this guy. I hate to use that word over your phone, but he was one of the worst correction officers. He was sneaking up on people, and, you know, I heard he had rumors of planning things, and lo and behold, that's how the universe works. He got wrapped up in that, and we never saw him again. But, yeah, it's a very vulnerable place, very vulnerable position, and like you said, independent oversight would be huge. It would be huge. And to anyone listening that has family in there, again, I implore you to make sure that they're working on the right things. I don't care if they're 35 years old and need to go back to basic reading. Encourage them to go back to education is everything, you know, and finding a trade. You know, education, and if they're just sitting around aimless, try to find some correspondent course college courses. They have those. I think it was running like $50 a course at the time, which is peanuts by comparison. So, you know, if you're paying $50 a course for a correspondence course that is accredited college, encourage them to do it so they can transfer those credits outside. And then if they're working in any trade that's inside the school, because I'm living proof that they will honor your prison experience. I did an article for the New Hampshire Center for Justice and Equality, my friend Ophelia Burnett and I, and I spoke about that in mine. Like, they should be honoring the work experience. If you did 7 years and you did your entire 7 years in a mess hall, there's no reason that you shouldn't be coming out here in the food industry with certifications. Or if you were in a warehouse, you should have your forklift license. That increases your pay. Or if you were doing plumbing, get ready for apprenticeships and things along those lines. So make the most of your stay. Never will you be in a position again, even though it's the worst kind of position to be in, but never will you be in, it's going to be hard-pressed to find yourself in a position where your food, clothing, and shelter are taken care of, even at the very minimum and worst. You know, it's the worst food, it's the worst clothing, it's the worst shelter. But you have to stay positive in that and then figure out those nuggets and how you're going to use them to be successful on the outside.
Exactly. You know, they have, a lot of people don't know it, but when incarcerated people are released, they can go on the internet and type in financial aid for former prisoners or ex-offenders. They can type in financial aid or funding or grants for ex-offenders. There's so many things out there. Criminon International offers free correspondence courses too for the incarcerated. And And that's another thing they can sign up for, contact Criminon International. That's on the internet as well. But there's a lot of programs. I wanted to ask you real quickly, too, your thoughts on single cells. I understand there's a lot of cells that are vacant in prisons around the country, and yet they force a lot of people to double cell when they don't want to or they can't. So what are your thoughts on forcing prisoners to double cell?
Oh man, I hated that. For single cells, what I will say is this. I'm not playing devil's advocate. What I will say is this. Make sure the person has doesn't have a history of mental health where they're trying to hurt themselves, or make sure that they don't have any illnesses, like deep, heavy illnesses. In a situation like that, I would encourage another person, because especially if you got a good bunk mate and, you know, the guy under you, he has a bottom bunk, he may be sick with something. No, I think he should have someone around him. But by and large, no, you don't want to cram. You know, I would love to, that was a bonus to have your own cell, you know, for a while. But the only reason they want to double bunk, Leona, is because it's more beds, and prison is big money. You know, it's big money. You know, the private prisons and the food industries that supply them, there's just a chain of people who are a small percentage, but a chain of them who are profiting from prisons, you know, and that is part of it. We jam more people in there, you know, and we better know. I think it's unhealthy, first of all, because, you know, especially with the COVID, 6 feet, you can't have 6 feet of distance like that. So one has to come before the other. You know, so if your cellmate's sick, guess what? You'll be sick too. You know, so that alone, unless they find isolation, you know?
It's sad because there are prisoners who try to maintain their hygiene, and then we know there are prisoners who don't care. I don't know
right.
prisoners. I don't know. You probably would know this, but are prisoners allowed to pick and choose if they're going to be double-celled? Are they allowed to choose who they want to be double-celled with?
Depending on where you are. And, you know, some prisons, you know, they want to try to keep you with your race just in case a war or something happens. You know, you want to be with your own kind, even though it makes no sense out in society, but inside that's just what it is. So some places are like that. And then some will, depending, like in a county, I know certain counties like, hey, I want to move in with my friend. All right, when that happens, then we'll move you in, you know, and that happens. So depending on where you are and what's going on, yeah, that can happen.
I think the DOC around the country need to do another thing too. What they do is they put prisoners in, put them in like cattle. Like you say, these big corporations are making all kinds of money, the prisons for profit and everything else. But what I was going to say is when they put these people in prison, I think they should put the people in prison, the elderly on a block or in a prison where there's all elderly. I think they need to put gang members in their own prisons. I think they need to put, you know, like the wrongfully convicted or the first-time offenders, especially those who are victims before becoming offenders, they need to categorize the people that they're incarcerating. What they do is they throw them all in like it's cattle. You know, they don't care who they place them with. And this is very disturbing, because I think that this is what's causing so much dysfunction in the prisons. It's causing so much chaos, rioting. It's causing a lot of, you know, suicide. They need to stop putting these people in prison accordingly instead of just cramming them all in. We know in Massachusetts, there's a prisoner in one prison. He's been advocating for some lifers who went into prison when they were very, very young, and now they're in their 80s, they're in their 90s, they're in wheelchairs, they have dementia, they have Parkinson's disease. You know, some of them are terminally ill. These people don't need to be in prison for one thing, and if they're going to be, put them on a block where they can relate to the ones that they're incarcerated with.
Right. Let's hope that I'll tell you what, too, and I don't pick any political sides, but I happened to be inside, Leona, when Eric Holder was the attorney general, and Obama was in there, and I saw men in tears, and I read the letter that was signed by Obama and Eric Holder, right? And some of those guys were in there 30 years, marijuana, crack, you name it, right? And Obama and his administration was pushing for it. And then, to be fair, I was in between two administrations, so, you know, I also saw people leaving out of there with Trump's signature on it. You know, like, hey, get this person out of jail. What are they doing in jail? Okay, this guy's 70-something years old. He put him on an ankle bracelet and let him live his last days out in society. You know, let him learn how to function. So let's hope that, you know, we need to be writing our congressmen and congresswomen. And that's where civic discourse and civic engagement come in. And that's another thing that I think should be taught inside of the prison. Civic engagement and civic discourse. We need to be voting and then find out what your rights are to vote. Well, we just found it out in New Hampshire. I voted for my first time in my life 4 years ago, you know, for my life, you know. And so, We need to be a part of that process. Now I'm voting for aldermen, councilwoman. I don't care what it is. You want to be involved in that process because that's your true power. It's not in a handgun. It's not in how much drugs you sold. It's not in the bank that you robbed. You know, you want to affect change, we got to get inside of these courtrooms, you know.
And, you know, you might want to connect with Brian Winters. Brian Winters was a politician. He is no longer a politician. He started American Union. American Union, if you're for the cause, whatever party is for the cause, that's the party that his organization will support at the time. And the cause is mass incarceration is one of the causes. So Brian Winters is in Vermont, and I'll tell you, Vermont and Maine and D.C. are the only states and district where they never took away the rights of prisoners to vote.
Right,
Never.
Yeah.
Now, I want to say something positive about Maura Healey, our new governor, because Maura Healey announced on the show, on the radio, on the news about a week ago, that she is going to be releasing thousands of prisoners in Massachusetts who have been incarcerated for marijuana usage.
Let them go.
And this is, I believe, with all the years that our former governor, Charlie Baker, was in, there was no hope for any of them. Maura Healey is going to be releasing thousands of prisoners that have been serving for marijuana because marijuana is now legal. It has been for a couple of years, two or three years. And also, people who have been in prison for some time, for years, are going to have an opportunity also to file for clemency. But this brings me right back to my first question, is what happens to those people who have been in for years and have been deprived? So now they have an opportunity to apply for clemency, but they're not going to get it because they have nothing to show for every incident that they tried to participate in programs. What they do have are grievances and civil suits, the documents from civil suits, which never went through, because one of the prisoners tried to file a civil suit when they were being denied of all their privileges. And what happened months into the suit, the prisoner was put in the hole. The department, the officials filed a motion to have his case dismissed. And once it was dismissed in the court, they released the prisoner from the hole. When the prisoner was going to file an appeal to the court, then the coronavirus came in for those 3 years. And what happened is they took his law books, they gave them to the library, and they kept him on a restricted block the entire time. So these are the kind of things that they do. And I want to say one more thing that prisoners have told me throughout the years. When they have staff that gets fired for doing something illegal, what they do is they don't fire them. They move them to another prison in another location, and they get put on office duty or something like that. But these are some things that go on. Now, Anthony, we've been talking all this time. I would like for you now to tell the audience all about the multimedia work that you do and how you're able to do it. Talk about your thing now.
So I was freelance writing for the Grand Estate News Collaborative. It's a statewide news collaborative here in New Hampshire. And I was an individual. And the entrepreneur in me said, hey, why not become a company, an entity, right? And so that's what I did. And up under that bridge, I wanted to help because I wound up winning awards for Columnist of the Year, two podcasting first place awards, also a journalism award, a New England journalism award. And so I started exploring Nashua. Nashua is the second largest city in New Hampshire, outside of where I am here in Manchester, and it was what they described as news desert. And I was trying to help, I am trying to help bring local news, almost like community service, like putting on a BIPOC community, BIPOC community, everyone. And also I want to break other journalists, young journalists. This is a dying field. And I think when these young people, even if they're pointed on TikTok, they're just destroying what the fundamental journalists are. So that's one project, National Vision. I'm also in partnership with Matt Loeb School Communications up there, and I'm developing podcasts in there where I'm speaking from my perspective, someone that's formerly incarcerated, and I can talk on everything from engagement to what's going on with our youth, at-risk youth, to local businesses and nonprofits And I want to have that theme on there. And I, like I said, I want to be able to show that there are men and women who are being released back into to society who are able to make things work and make things happen. So, yeah, and I plan on writing a play and a screenplay up under Anthony Payton Media. The TED Talk was huge. If you guys didn't get to see it, it's you can just go to YouTube and punch in Anthony Payton TED Talk, and you'll see. Leona, I always laugh. I tell people there's a picture of me with both my hands out. I look like an idiot, but you know when they catch you on those when they catch you with one of those pictures, it's like okay, that is the still shot. So you can see it. And in that TED Talk, I talk about incarceration and fatherhood and how having a father was very important for me, even though I made mistakes. But just having that father there was big. And then my daughter, who's now 10, going on 40, if you let her tell it. And, you know, and she's just my light. Everything I'm pushing and doing is for her. And so, yeah, and that's what I'm doing with media as of this moment. I got my fingers crossed that some big.
Okay, Anthony, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I'm sorry we broke up.
I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, it said. Anyway, we're back on. So you were talking about you had your hands out, and that's where it pretty much.
So if you go to YouTube and you look for Anthony Payton TED Talk. You'll see me. I have a black shirt, and my hands look like I'm shrugging. I look like a complete idiot, but that is the still shot that they caught of me. So no complaints. But in that TED Talk, I do talk about fatherhood, incarceration, and how important it was for me to have a father, even though I made the wrong, you know, some wrong choices. But his guidance and my mother's guidance was still there. And I guess the gist of it is, you know, although imperfect, fatherhood is still impactful. You know, imperfection doesn't negate importance, you know, and that is what it is. I think you guys might cry a little bit and laugh a little bit from what everyone tells me. And yeah, my daughter, she's 10 years old, going on 40, if you let her tell it. But, you know, and she is my she's my everything, you know, and why I do what I'm doing, to make sure she has some legacy left whenever I leave this physical world. So it's, and whatever other, you know, her brothers as well, you know. So yeah, that's what I'm doing with the media stuff. I'm still working. I plan on getting more certifications in the food industry so I can, continue to climb up those ranks and maybe food and beverage, administrator. So, and then potentially, if able, I'll move away from that and be doing more community activism and community work. So yeah, the possibilities are endless if you just stay focus. And also, this is so big, surround yourself with people who inspire you. If you look around and you're the smartest person in that room, get the heck out of that room immediately. Get out of that room. If you're the smartest person in the room, get out of that room and find another room. And that is the creed that I live by, those things there. So.
And why do you say that?
Because you want to continue to learn. Right. If you're the smartest person in the room, I think you hit your ceiling. You know, there's trying to find more inspiration or learn things that you don't know. You'll find yourself more as a teacher than as a student. And I believe that you can be 95 years old and still be a student and a student of life as well. You know, because, you know, this world and this universe and our creator has put so many beautiful things here. There's no way you can map everything out in 45, 50 years. You know, so continue to aspire and be around people who inspire you, you know, and get out of that comfort zone. Leona, I come from a very hyper-masculine environment, you know, and now, you know, I got friends dragging me to karaoke and stuff like that. It's like, okay, all right, let's do it. Let's do it. Let me get out of my comfort zone. I grow like this, you know, so hopefully getting some real estate ventures soon. Learning the game a little bit more. I've always loved the thought of investing in parking lots and land and things along those lines. Learning AI is very, you know, it's very, and my work and things that I do is very, very helpful. So I suggest that formerly incarcerated people also learn that, just to stay a step ahead of the ball and, you know, make the most of what you know, whatever trade you do, You know, I know a woman and some black women that's down in Nashua. They started out with a food cart. Now they just moved into a huge building, you know, and they're doing catering and they're rocking. And I plan on doing a story on them soon, you know, through my media outlet. And it's a beautiful thing. Very, very beautiful, Leona. So,
as I mentioned too earlier, on March 13th, I interviewed Franz Dell, a former warden from Amsterdam, and Gary Cohen, a criminal defense attorney from Texas. And they were very interested in a plan that we spoke about the benefits it would bring if government lawmakers and leaders were to hold a convention every year or every few years on to discuss the prison issues around the country and the world, including ways to rehabilitate and release the incarcerated population, mainly in the United States with the 2.3 million people incarcerated. So we were talking about that, and we, because with Amsterdam, with Franz Dell and others like that, they, their whole incarceration facilities and everything are so different. Their programs are much better, and they don't have mass incarceration unless it involves terrorism or serial killing or mass shootings. But the maximum their sentencing is 25 years. So we discussed holding a virtual meeting, and we're going to be discussing it again on April 2nd at 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. And we're extending an invitation to anyone that wants to call in or listen in. And also, when we do set up the virtual meeting, we will let everybody know if they want to be a part of it. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to get our legislative members, our government leaders, the lawmakers, to start coming together in with other governors in other countries and going over all these to find out how we can benefit from what they're going to be sharing with us. And that's one of the things is it's very important, because you touched on a lot of these things that need to be improved in the United States prisons. A lot of
things. Right.
And these are issues that we're going to be listing, so that when in Franz, he's an expert. Franz is working with the United Nations. He's been working with the Ministry of Psychiatry, and these are global organizations. And he's been working with the International Red Cross. He's been in, you know, he's been in Massachusetts prisons. He's been in the New York prisons. He's working with the criminal defense attorney in Texas right now, in Texas prisons. And so when this time comes, I would love to have you come back, because I want to try to get as many advocates in the United States as well, but also to try to get our legislative members, if everybody can just connect with them and let them know this is going to be benefiting us. Because one of the things you said, Anthony, is call your legislative members. This is good. We need to call our legislative members, but we shouldn't have to. Because if they go into the prisons on a regular basis and meet with these prisoners, meet with these incarcerated individuals to find out what is needed, how they can help. And I will say Senator Jamie Eldridge and Senator Liz Miranda, House Representative Mary Keith in Massachusetts, these are people that have been going into the prisons at least once or twice a year. But as they've told prisoners in the past, they're only a handful. But if all of these people started going into the prison, meeting with the incarcerated individuals around the country, then we would not have to let them know what the problems are. And we would not have to know that there needs to be oversight in the prison system. This is very important, that there should be oversight. But I'm going to call 605. You want to state your name, please?
Yeah, this is Chanupa from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. I'm with some of my inmates right here that are on parole. You know, it's kind of very astonishing what you're talking about. And, move those logs. Yeah. Anyway, I'm showing these guys how to cut wood and, you know, another rehabilitation program that we do. I got 19 federal and state inmates here on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And
wow.
I deal with this on a contrary level because, you know, white America has always did things chronically, okay, according to handbooks and procedures, but they never get a chance for our federal and state inmates or even county to find an avenue for them to rehabilitate themselves in the communities. Okay. So as a as a native guy, I do this all the time. And when I go to these meetings that they have, you know, when the prison boards come in and they look at different issues going on, and I don't want to take too much talking about. On the 23rd of this weekend, they're having a prisoners reform project up there in Rapid City, South Dakota. So I was summoned to go to that, which I am going to go, because these newly appointed board members, they're new. The old ones, they retired. And a lot of them don't look at the brothers and sisters more on a human level. Let's put it that way.
Just
right away, man, you're going to be like, oh, yeah, you got to march and watch him, monitor him and all that. Well, first of all, that might be the norm, but you're monitoring yourself too, see?
Mm-hmm.
But these guys see that. They always be right and we're wrong. But they never were. They're always going to say, oh, we ain't wrong. No, 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 we're not white enough, so it doesn't quantify to that. That's the problem. That might be offensive, but it is.
Right.
See, if you orally look at incarceration, incarceration is under a controlled movement. Mm-hmm. You know that. I know that. And if you've been in the system, you have to have a pass like outside. It's like an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
You have an appointment to get into where you want to get examined for whether it's the health issue or whatever. That's the norm. The same way with the institution, because they're trying to eliminate the private sectors. In other words, you have states like Nebraska, for instance. They call it the NSP, the Nebraskan State Penitentiary. You got Leavenworth, Kansas is a United States federal penitentiary. See? So now there's new illustrations of incarceration institutions that are coming up. They're FCIs. They're federal correctional institution. So the private sectors are doing that, like Tecumseh, Nebraska. That's the private sector. They don't have a name for it. See? They want a piece of that money, too. But then when our brothers and sisters get discharged, there's nothing waiting for them.
Right.
See?
Right.
That's the problem. So guys like myself and many others that are trying to do something, because I'm an ex-convict. I am. And I masquerade with that openly, because I tell them, look, but you guys are ex-cons. You guys, when you came over here in them ships back in ancient times, all were released from prison. So you brought that mentality over here.
Right.
So now we're living in that. We're living in your demise, but you can't take it back and impose it on your people that did that to you. See? Mm-hmm.
You know what I think would be an awesome, what I think would be an awesome idea, especially like, as you mentioned, cultures. What I think would be an excellent idea is if all of you came together and look at with Anthony, he's the award-winning multimedia entrepreneur. Chinupa, you've been working a lot with the federal and state prisoners of the Indian, Native Indians, and other organizations, other advocates. I think if all of you kind of like connected and did a virtual meeting yourselves, you know, on a Zoom meeting and talked about, even write up a proposal and send it to the Department of Justice to ask them if they would allow you as a group and give yourselves a name and allow you as a group to go into the prisons and to be able to share and to be able to teach them and be able to help them. And then we could get philanthropists to provide the funding for you to go in, because there are philanthropists for social change in criminal justice reform and all of these things. If you could get the Department of Justice to allow all of you to come together as a, you could call it the alliance, you know, the some kind of alliance thing where you could go in and do exactly what they're not doing behind those prison walls. All of it is uniting. And like I said, Brian Winters, American Union up in Vermont, and Denise Capo with the Society First in Florida, and the Chinupa and them, and you as well, Anthony, and there's so many others. And there's a school, it's called the Urban Law School, and that's with Jonah Sanders. He's written so, so many books about all the injustice. I believe he was in prison as a youth teenager too. He's a grown man now, but he's got the organization. Connect with all of these people. Come together and even if you did it on a radio show to recruit, to do this alliance, because all of you are so gifted. You've been there, you've done it, and you're out, you're succeeding. This is the time to come together and try to figure out a way that you can all go in as a coalition or as a foundation or something. And start actually meeting with these prisoners.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense to do it more collectively because I plan on going back to New Hampshire State Prison. I'm just waiting for clearance. And I know as a group, we could have, like, if I had a group behind me, it could have been a lot more smoother. But no, that makes a complete sense, though, Leona. Yeah, I like that idea.
And as they said with that deep heart, these are people that go all over the world touring in the prisons all over the world. They know about the injustices. And Chinupa, I think you should connect with her, too. I think you should connect with them. They do it through music, but they go into the prisons all over the world. And right now in Colombia, they're talking about one of the worst prisons they're in right now that they've been going to. So I don't know. I just feel like all of you should come together and try to do something with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep, I agree. Yep.
What are your thoughts on that, Chinupa?
Well, let me put it in this context. You know, I'm working with a group here. It's called the Prisoners Outreach Program. Okay? The Prisoners Outreach Program is called POP. Prisoners Outreach Program. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what we did is, and what we're still doing, is alleviating some of the families to get involved. Okay? Any loved one, whether it's a federal or a state, inmate, mm-hmm. we get the families to try to recognize what type of issue made them, being neglectful by the system. Now, the system does this. They monitor everything, even your letters. They're censored.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to find a way to stop that because you're allowed in certain institutions certain type of personal support from outside, whether it's a photo or, they make these little poster things with about maybe 6 or 7 pictures on it, and the families can have that to hang on their wall. But these things are always, man, scrutinized. The system does this. Nobody. What I'm trying to do to help these guys understand is, we want them to see how they're being treated in there,
mm-hmm.
firsthand. Okay, and some of the the warden in Tecumseh, he's like, well, we got to do a fair capacity. I said, no, don't use that word, fair capacity. Okay, what I'm saying is, when you go home to your wife and your children, you treat them like your brothers and sisters that are incarcerated in your facility. You treat them. And they got quiet because what's at home they bring to work. What's at work they take it home. Vice versa. See?
Yes.
And nobody talks about that. You know that, and I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But to alleviate that stress, because a lot of our brothers and sisters, they're always getting subjugated to ADSEG, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I've been in ADSEG, but we didn't call it ADSEG. They call it the whole.
Yeah.
So I understand the mentality between, the whole and ADSEG. There's a difference. ADSEG gives you a certain privilege because you're inside of a cell. The whole, there's like 12 of them down there.
Mm-hmm.
The light is above you about maybe 12 feet. And that's the only light that we all can get together on by heads and read our material. And then, we get this discharge from that. We're on a thin mat, and when you're getting fed in there, it's only a sack lunch, a half an apple, a carton of milk, and a butter sandwich.
Yep.
So this is what kind of thing I know And when you try to tell, that's inhuman, man. That's still going on today as we're talking.
Yep. It sure is.
People are nobody out there in the public is making this kind of demise against them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how scrutiny does. But the institution promotes a different psychological racism, okay? Mm-hmm. And you know that.
Yep.
They'd rather have you not participate in any of them programs.
Mm-hmm.
They like being, you know, subjugated you into segregation, the whole, and whatever. Any type of disparity in faction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Native people, we say this when we get educated. And education, it might be a tool to some, but in reality, it ain't.
Mm.
Kill the Indian, save the man, okay? That's what education means, okay?
Mm.
So when they kill the Native person in you, you forget your language. You forget that you have a traditional name that's of the earth and the animals.
Mm.
And now you're going by Billy Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Or Henry Michael, you know, no Caucasian names.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't fit with us, okay? So that's the continuation of indoctrination.
Mm-hmm.
So us guys getting together to go in and meet them, I want federal and state legislators to look at how they're being treated in there. See?
Yep.
That's the way. Then we can sit at the table and start sharing a hamburger and, you know, together. But until then, you have to correct your institution. This is what's happening. That's why they come out, repeat the same cycle that put them in there.
We have about 3.5 minutes left, but I want to say, I'm going to say this once again. The problem isn't all the prison system. The problem is the people that don't want to do anything but focus on the past. And I keep saying this, and it's like I watch TV all the time to get the world news and the national news, and I'm hearing the same old, same old. They're talking about this, and they're talking about that. They're not talking about anything that makes sense to actually do something. This World Prison Tour, this is what they do. We perform a rehabilitating, educational, and transformative show of music, magic, comedy, theater, and dance. This is in the prisons. Through the presentation, we create a platform where we can teach, inspire, and create a personal connection with those incarcerated to offer an unforgettable and offer life-changing experiences. These are the things that they do. What I'm trying to do myself, because I'm a networker, and that's how I network with people all over the country, and this is how things get done. This is why a lot of people are so glad and thankful, because they say now they have been building up their own inspiration to start doing something. We need to stop talking about what they do, because we already know what they do. It's like the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatrists. They're getting all this funding to do research. We already know what the problem is. Get your asses out and get something going. But these people are getting all this money to talk about nothing. They're talking about things we already know about. We're already advocates. We already have loved ones inside. We already know people who have been inside. We need to figure out how we can come together. We, as a people, come together and start making plans to put a proposal together and to get in contact with the Department of Justice, or even, like you said earlier, our legislative members, and say, listen, we got this proposal. We want to go in, and we want to start working with these incarcerated individuals as well. We are at the level now where we can. I am an award-winning multimedia entrepreneur and a reentry advocate. I want to be able to now start helping, because I know what they're not getting inside. And Chinupa Gunamani has been advocating for these prisoners for so long, he has that ability to get involved too. And to put this proposal together and say, we are experienced. We are professionals. We know what we're doing. We've been there, done it, and now we want to make a change. We cannot keep talking about what was. We cannot keep talking about the problems, because we know what the problem is. Let's show society that it takes people on the outside to make changes on the inside. Now, we have about 60 seconds left, so Anthony, if you can let the audience know how to get in contact with you, and also Chinupa, if you can let the audience know how to get in contact with you if they want to get off their tail and do something as well. We need to stop talking. This country is all about whining and talking and all this.
Yep.
And nothing gets
done. Mm-hmm. Oh, so What's that brother's name? Chinook? I'm sorry.
Chinupa.
Chinupa, find me, and everyone else, please find me at Anthony Payton, A-N-T-H-O-N-Y, Payton, P-A-Y-T-O-N, 111 at gmail.com. That's the numbers 111. Anthony Tone Payton on most social media. Please find me.
Yeah, and my information, just reach me on the phone, okay? My phones are the common way to get at me because I'm computer illiterate, and I thank the great mystery for that. But reach me at 605-517-2621. Again, 605-517-2621. And then my home office where I'm at, 605-517-1547. Again, 605-517-1547. You can reach me there, and it'll be good to hear from you too, brother. And Leona, thank you for having a good show, man. I love it.
Thank you.
I want to say something to the audience. You know, these audience, there's so many people out in society that talk about crime and they can't stand it. They talk about their fear of crime, but yet they will pay all kinds of money to watch all these violent movies on TV. You're giving your money to these producers who are taking real life experiences and putting them in movies. Audience, it's time that you stop, because if you don't want the violence in this country, if you don't want the violence in your communities, then stop watching these movies. Stop paying for it. Start getting involved in trying to resolve the issue. You have been listening to the radio show every single time, listening to people who have been there and done it, and people who don't need to be out here doing this because they've already served their time. But they're trying to make things right so the communities will be safe. While all of you, or many of you, are watching these violent movies, getting a big kick out of it. Halloween, you can't wait for Halloween to come so you can do all this evil stuff out in the community. Don't be sitting back and gossiping with one another. Start getting involved. I have never seen a country so let. I went to Africa one time. I was in Africa in 1995 and 96. I started New Vision out there. I was working with people in the villages. I had volunteers coming to me. I don't know where they were coming from. The Ghana, the fire department, they let us have our inauguration there, free of charge. People coming from all over the regions. What is wrong with this country? This country is about nothing but whining. They don't do anything but talk. And that's why nothing gets done, and then everybody wants to play the blame game. And I'll tell you, these politicians, the president and his wife, and talking about how hurt they were because of all this that was going on with their son who was being charged with some kind of crime. They don't remember, or they don't realize we are all family members that are hurting. And I'm sick and tired of them just because they're politicians, just because they got all this money, crying like babies about their pain and forgetting about everybody else's pain. We have people in prison who were victims before becoming offenders. We have wrongfully convicted. We have a penal system that's abusing while they're inside, depriving, provoking, harassing, tormenting. Get with it, America. And thank you guys for being on. I appreciate you coming
on. Thank you.
And look forward to
you.
The next show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Be in touch soon.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you,
call me and let's commute a dialogue, man. Let's get it going, brother.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much, man. I will be in touch with you, brother. I appreciate you.